To be elected Phoenix mayor in 2011, Greg Stanton had to overcome a number of opponents, including some of his former city council colleagues. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll look at what's next for Stanton. Last night, his re-election campaign officially started. Dustin Gardner of the Arizona Republic will tell us what sort of competition Stanton should expect. Plus, a new effort at Arizona State aims to balance economic development, growth, and natural resources. It's called the Large Landowner Initiative. We'll talk with real estate expert Mark Stapp and former state land commissioner Vanessa Hickman about what's involved in the initiative. Also, a new play making its debut at Arizona Theater Company tries its hand at explaining what happened when America's then five living presidents gathered in California for Richard Nixon's funeral. I'll talk with playwright Rick Cleveland. And have you ever thought about hiking in Antarctica? I'll be joined by two guests who've done just that. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, an innovative initiative aims to combine economic development with the management of natural resources and real estate planning. I'll talk with former state land commissioner Vanessa Hickman and real estate expert Mark Stapp about the Large Landowners Initiative. Plus, what would it be like to eavesdrop on former U.S. presidents? That's what writer Rick Cleveland was aiming for with his new play, Five Presidents, which is receiving its world premiere in Arizona. Cleveland brings together the five presidents who were living at the time of Richard Nixon's funeral. I'll talk with Cleveland. Also, a hike up Camelback Mountain or through the Superstitions is strenuous. But would you be up for a hike in Antarctica? I'll be joined by two National Geographic explorers who did just that. We start today's program with City of Phoenix politics. Last night, Mayor Greg Stanton officially kicked off his re-election campaign. We'll get a couple of perspectives on how Stanton has done in his first term. Meanwhile, Dustin Gardner, who covers City Hall for the Arizona Republic, joins me with an overview. Dustin, good morning.
How you doing?
Good. Let's start off with an article you wrote last night for AZ Central. How many viable challengers is Mayor Stanton expected to face and from all over the political spectrum?
Well, we don't have any declared challengers at this point, but it does look like there will be potentially a few. We're hearing one city union ask me, talking about fielding a candidate from the left side of the aisle. And then on the right side, we have people talking about potentially drafting Christine Jones. And Christine Jones was the well-known gubernatorial candidate, former GoDaddy CEO, but she said she has not decided to run. She's at least not planning to run at this point, but that could change at some point.
Are you getting the impression yet, I know it's early, from the Stanton campaign that they will be ready for challengers or no?
I think they're pretty confident at this point. His polling from everything I've heard is pretty good. He's got quite a bit of money in the bank, hundreds of thousands raised. So at this point, I don't think they feel like they have anything to worry about.
Dustin, what sort of changes have you seen in Greg Stanton the past few years as mayor? Has anything stood out as far as when he came into office as opposed to where he's at now?
Yeah, I think the mayor's leadership style has evolved in a couple of significant ways. When he first came in, he had some early stumbles trying to build coalitions with the city council, and his agenda wasn't very specific. I think some insiders feel like he's gotten a little more specific and detailed with his policies. For example, he championed an effort to make Phoenix the first city to eliminate homelessness among veterans. Another example is he has been pushing some pension reforms and created a committee to lead that. So I think to some degree people feel like he is becoming more assertive and more detailed.
You mentioned the council members, and I think a lot of us obsessed to some extent about how well people get along and whether that matters, but how do he and council members get along, even those that perhaps he disagrees with on certain things?
Honestly, his relations with the council aren't great. He's not been seen as a mayor who often reaches out to the city council, but saying that, he has been successful on a lot of the key issues at building, you know, the five-vote coalition needed to get things done. A key example that comes to mind is the budget last year. That was a 5-4 vote, and there was a lot of disagreement over the police union contract in particular. And he was able to put together the coalition to support that. So I think when the rubber hits the road, he's put together the votes, but in general, his relationship has not been great, particularly his relations with the more conservative arm of the council, Councilman Sal DiCicco, Councilman Jim Waring. It's, you know, there's a degree of politeness at meetings, sometimes not so polite at meetings, but there's a general feeling that he's not communicated with that arm of the council.
Mm. Does that feel like a personality clash more than an issues disagreement?
I would say the personality clash would be between him and Councilman Sal DiCicco. I guess the rivalry between those two has a lot of times defined the political dynamics of City Hall in the last couple of years. It's, you know, often issues are framed in the, you know, the Sal side of the council. He's often the, you know, the most outspoken conservative, and then Greg often represents the more liberal side, and their personality clash has been pretty visible, I would say.
Yeah. Now, the city of Phoenix, like the state of Arizona, is facing another big budget shortfall. In a city that has a powerful city manager position like Phoenix does, how much impact can the mayor have? How much impact is the mayor expected to have, at least when it comes to leading on that issue?
I think it's important to remember that Phoenix is a council manager form of government. The city manager is ultimately responsible for coming up with a budget proposal and implementing it. But, you know, the mayor is one of the 9 council votes, and he, you know, is seen as the city's symbolic leader and does have the ability to, you know, use the bully pulpit to drive things. And, you know, budget deficits have definitely defined quite a bit of Stanton's tenure. And I think typically he's been a little bit more reserved on fiscal issues, especially when it comes to the budget. He's often, you know, let the city manager kind of set the tone, and then towards the end of the process, been more vocal about how he feels about the city manager's proposal. So it'll be interesting this year as the city faces another budget deficit. We're hearing it's most likely going to be another budget deficit. The size, we're unsure at this point. We're waiting for a forecast from the city. But it'll be interesting to see at this point, toward the end of his first term, if he's going to be willing to get out a little bit more ahead on that. Like I said, in the past, he's kind of sat back and let city management form that, but he, you know, if he chooses to, maybe this year we'll see him take a more assertive role.
And Dustin, briefly, I wanted to close with that because you're going to be covering the budget stuff pretty intensely, and I'm wondering how bumpy you think that's going to be. If there is a deficit, no matter what size, is that going to be tough considering the city came out of a huge deficit just a few years back?
Yeah, it's looking like it could be a pretty bumpy process. Last year, you know, the city created a new utility tax on water bills, and it cut employee pay and benefits to close a $38 million deficit. This time around, there's probably not going to be any more cuts for employees because they're in the middle of a 2-year contract. There are cuts already built into those contracts, but I mean in addition to what's in the contract. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, how they're going to close it, it remains to be seen, but their, you know, their two primary options are either going to be reducing services to the public or raising taxes, or cutting spending. So I guess that'd be the third option. We'll see how they pull it together. It's going to be a tough pull, I think.
Dustin Gardner covers Phoenix City Hall for the Arizona Republic. Dustin, thanks as always.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Catherine Alonzo is a partner at Javelina, a public affairs firm in the Valley. Wanted to get her perspectives on Mayor Stanton. Catherine, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
So what have been Mayor Stanton's greatest accomplishments in your view in his first term?
There's a lot to talk about. He has been such a fantastic champion for really altering our economy away from one that was incredibly reliant on construction and real estate, and really has revolutionized it toward a much more innovation-based, trade-focused economy. So what that looks like in, you know, two really great examples of that is fantastic relationships that he's built with Mexico. There is now a trade office open in Mexico City, which was something that he ran on when he ran for election and promised that, and that's been realized. And then also the fantastic moves that have been made in the bioscience industry. You know, Greg was one of the lead city council members on bringing TGen to downtown Phoenix, and has been committed to the biosciences for many years and has really continued that great work as mayor. You know, one of the great things we've seen with that is the $130 million campus that's going to be opened in downtown Phoenix a collaboration between University of Arizona and St. Joe's, which is going to be a world-class cancer facility right in our downtown area.
His energy level is pretty remarkable, but I think it rubs some people the wrong way. Has he toned that down a little bit? We're keeping the energy level without sort of having his hands in everything? Because it did seem like when he started, he wanted to have his hands in everything.
That's interesting. I think that his energy level is a fantastic asset. You know, he cares deeply. He says and truly believes that he has the best job in the world. And I think one of the temptations of that is trying to do everything, perhaps. But I think the way that's iterated itself during his first 4 years is there has been tremendous steps forward in so many areas, in the economic development, in transportation, in education, in making Phoenix an inclusive city that's open to business for everybody. And I don't know that you can achieve that without his energy.
Does he want to do more but is restricted in some ways by the city manager setup we have?
I think he absolutely wants to do more, but as you've seen from what he's achieved, that he works tremendously well with the city manager and is a partner in really moving our city forward. So I don't think it's been a limitation. I don't think it will be for the next 4 years.
Catherine, it's the sixth largest city in America, and I guess with that come enormous expectations, even coming out as we did from the Great Recession and how much that hit the valley. But there are still some people who say that Phoenix, based on the fact that it's the sixth largest, even with a bunch of large suburbs such as Mesa and Scottsdale, that Phoenix needs to be even bolder with what it tries to do and its leadership. Is that something that you agree with or disagree with? And is that something that Mayor Stanton would be prepared to do?
Absolutely. And I think when you see what has happened with the trade relationships with Mexico, that's such a fantastic example. You know, Arizona's image has really been tarnished by SB 1070 a few years ago. And Mayor Stanton had run on the trade office and has absolutely made it happen. And so, you know, when you see a bold vision like that against all odds, it has come to fruition. I think that the sky is the limit for what else can be achieved.
It looks like the budget could be another issue coming up. Obviously, the state is facing another deficit that will affect some of the cities. Phoenix will unlikely be one of them, or most likely be one of them. I guess going forward on that, how much does Mayor Stanton have to do in terms of ideas? How much does he have to work with the city manager? And how much does he have to be good at convincing fellow council members to go along with his vision?
I think those are all really important skills when you're looking at balancing a budget. And look, you know, those are skills that he's had to use over the last 4 years. Don't forget that under his tenure, the food tax was eliminated. So out of a very difficult recession, and, you know, we're still emerging from that and still, you know, looking at what the new reality looks like, the fact that he cut taxes and has managed to grow our economy is really quite a remarkable achievement, and wouldn't have been able to do that unless he'd have used all the skills that you know and mentioned.
What are his ambitions going forward? I know Mayor he loves Phoenix, he grew up here, but there are some on the Democratic side who would put pressure on him to do something else. Could people expect him to be Mayor of Phoenix for 4 more years if he wins again?
It's an interesting question. You know, I think you obviously have to never say never, but he certainly is very committed to Phoenix. As you said, he loves it, and I think his love for the city and his love for the job comes through in everything he does. As for the future, he's a talented and committed public official, and I think he has a lot to offer the city and the state.
Catherine Alonzo is a partner at the Phoenix-based public affairs firm Javelina. Catherine, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're talking about Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton's re-election bid, which officially got underway last night. Now we're joined by Tom Jenny, Arizona Director of the Americans for Prosperity. Tom, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So has Mayor Stanton earned re-election in your eyes?
My job is not to tell people who to vote for, who not to vote for, especially at the Phoenix level. But what I would tell people out there is, is that, well, for one thing, I would send them to our local government scorecard. We have a local government scorecard that we have created through our foundation that we've been doing for about 8 years now, and we track public officials. And if you look at the really, really big metrics, if you're looking at the overall Phoenix budget and the tax levy increases and some of the sales tax moves that we've done in the past few years, I think you could say, well, on our scorecard, right now, Greg Stanton is under the category of needs much improvement. This budget looks pretty good, the one that they just passed last summer. My guess is he'll move up in our ranking to needs improvement or not bad. And we try to just stick with the metrics on that. And so I think if you look at the really, really big picture, he's maybe his instincts are liberal, maybe his instincts are toward big government, but he hasn't blown up the budget. In fact, the budget during his time has actually gone down from about a high of $5.4 billion. We're down now to about $5.1 billion. Some of that has happened not necessarily because of his leadership, but just because of the pressures that are on the city. So I guess that's a long way of saying when you're looking at the really, really big metrics, he's not bad.
And what are your thoughts about how the city and also how he has handled pension reform?
That is a huge missed opportunity, I believe, and I feel like he has not provided a great leadership on that particular issue, and frankly, that's a place where our metrics probably don't show the whole picture. When I was talking about that $5.1 billion budget for the entire city, that includes the general fund, includes enterprise funds, and includes capital. One of the things it does not include, for better or for worse, is the long-term unfunded liabilities of the pension system. In 2003, Phoenix taxpayers were contributing about $56 million for the retirement system for city employees. By now, it has ballooned up to about $240 million. If you look at the unfunded debt, it's about $3 billion right now. That's huge. That's really huge. And that's a huge problem that Phoenix is going to have to deal with, not just Mayor Stanton, but everybody in Phoenix government is going to have to get a grip on that. And frankly, we have not. We passed up an opportunity this summer with Proposition 487 to get a real handle on pension financing going forward. The previous year we had, frankly, what I think was a sham reform championed by Mayor Stanton. So I would say that's in my view, the major missed opportunity for Mayor Stanton.
How concerned, Tom, are you about pension reform going forward as it relates to the city, the state overall, when we consider that there are steps that people basically universally think have to be taken, but you also try to balance that with what promises workers were given and yet not wanted to be a budget buster going forward?
I think Mayor Stanton is probably too close to the city employee unions, and I think that's going to be a major problem for him getting behind anything real and substantive in terms of pension reform. I think that's going to be a problem.
And Tom, let's look at the idea that the city's budget, it looks like the city of Phoenix is going to face a pretty heavy deficit again. At the same time, the state is facing that as well. Are the city's hands, in essence, tied by the state budget deficit?
Well, if you're talking about state shared revenue that might get cut back,
yeah.
In that sense, they are their hands are tied. There's not much they can do on that front. But there is still a lot that can be done in this city to reduce costs, to reduce the cost of operations. And there's, for instance, one of the things that could easily be done is to provide long-term concessions for the management, upkeep, maintenance of our city parks. That's something where we could, conceivably have a coffee shop in a park that's currently not getting a lot of great traffic anyway. And you could put something, you could put an entrepreneur in there, a business person in there who has an incentive, one, to attract customers, people who use the park because they'll come there maybe for a coffee shop or something. And then at the same time, because they're a long-term concession, they're going to have an incentive to want to make sure that the grass is mowed, to want to make sure that the graffiti's cleaned up, to want to make sure that they're keeping an eye on who's coming in and out of the park and possibly keep the police on speed dial. I think we could have opportunities like that where you end up actually managing, say, parks and recreation at a much lower cost and actually getting a better product.
And Tom, finally, though, this certainly does not appear to be on the table at the state level. At the city level, at the county level, I presume it won't happen either. But what are your thoughts in general about tax increases, revenue increases? If people wanted to go that direction, how opposed would you be?
We are generally opposed. When you're looking at that $5 billion budget for Phoenix, there's a lot that we could cut. There's a lot of frivolous programs that don't need to be here. And I think there's a lot we can do, even before going to things like long-term concessions to better manage the assets we have as a city. So I think there's a lot we could do that we're currently not doing. We don't even, as far as I'm concerned, we have a long, long way to go before anybody needs to start talking about revenue increases.
Tom Jenny is Arizona Director of the Americans for Prosperity Foundation. Tom, thanks for squeezing us in.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the Large Landowner Initiative and find out what exactly that is. And then a little bit later on this hour, we will kind of sort of hike in Antarctica, or at least talk to a couple of guys who've done it. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Montessori Day Schools, an A-graded charter district with private preschools and charter K-8 in Phoenix and Chandler. Open house, open enrollment Friday, February 6th, 4 to 7 p.m. MontessoriDayschools.org.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. Well, it should be a mostly sunny day across the state today. Right now, it's 66 degrees in Tucson, 61 in Casa Grande, 58 in Prescott, 57 degrees in Flagstaff, and 71 in Yuma. If you're traveling on the eastbound US 60 freeway, the Superstition, you can expect some lane restrictions for the next few hours as ADOT does some work in the HOV and left lanes between Mill Avenue and Rural Road. Right now, it's mostly sunny in Phoenix and 65 degrees at KJZZ at 1127.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The state of Arizona is the fifth largest in the country based on the amount of land, with more than 72 million acres. How is the state doing with management of that land, and how are private entities doing? The W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU is introducing the Large Landowner Initiative, which is intended to combine the interests of the public, the real estate industry, and government, among others. With me for a few minutes to talk about the Large Landowner Initiative are Vanessa Hickman, who will lead the program. She's Arizona's former state land commissioner. Vanessa, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also here is Mark Stapp, director of ASU's Master of Real Estate Development Program. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you.
Vanessa, let's start off at the core level here. What is the Large Landowner Initiative and why do we need it?
The Large Landowner Initiative is an opportunity for Arizona State University to tackle some of these issues that pertain to the economy, jobs, and growth, and the future of the real estate industry and how it's impacted by natural resource management. It will look at large institutional land holdings, both public and private, and look at these issues and how they affect these land holdings and their ability to maximize value on their assets in the future.
So when we talk about these big concepts, how do you get started, though? I mean, what are the points of emphasis that need to be in the mix here?
Sure. So as you know, for the last 5 years, I've worked at the Arizona State Land Department, recently making the move over to Arizona State University. And during that time, I was able to start working on some of these big issues that were affecting the trust that I was charged with managing. Mm-hmm. So we're really looking at some of the issues that were threatening to challenge the ability to make money off of some of the trust lands. And some of those issues are the Endangered Species Act, the proposed regulations under the Clean Water Act, and some of these other type of regulatory matters which will affect the amount of land that you're able to develop in the future. So we'll be focusing on those matters predominantly in the first year.
Mark, jump in on this as well, but are stakeholders prepared to try to find that balance? Because this is these issues you're mentioning, this is not an easy balance of finding out where do we get revenue? Where do we balance it with the concerns of the environment, natural resources?
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons why this makes sense to be in the finance department at the business school is that, you know, we study these trade-offs. And this is about land economics and the ability to yield revenue in a responsible way. And, you know, we're not looking at this from the standpoint of these federal regulations are bad, let's get rid of them. We're really looking at it in terms of the effect that they have and how to responsibly react to them so that there's an opportunity to shape the various programs that we have to deal with. And I have to emphasize, too, that this isn't just about Arizona. I mean, this initiative is really about large land holdings across the country. It just so happens that in this state, we have a particular set of issues because we're a growth community, and we have a lot of federal and state lands, and the land department is probably one of the most active of any in the western United States. And so we have the ability to tap someone like Vanessa in her various experiences in dealing with these issues.
Yeah, Vanessa, at its core, I know there's this dream to have, and maybe sometime soon, to have this look at a global scale. But how unique is Arizona when it comes to this? And how great is it that Arizona can be a pilot project, but at the same time, how challenging is it? Because some things that Arizona is going through, maybe a lot of other states have no idea about.
Well, and Arizona is in the top five in terms of the amount of public land within its borders. So we just recently had the Western States Land Commissioners Association winter meeting here in Phoenix, and were able to put on a number of discussions highlighting what Arizona has been working on in order to best utilize the private and state trust land and work with some of the federal agencies in making sure that we're making decisions going forward that can lead to what they need to do under their federal requirements and what we needed to do in terms of revenue production. So I think that Arizona really could be an example of partnerships and the ability to look at land proactively and to make decisions that can preserve the value of the land while complying with the requirements of federal law. And Arizona is one of the states that has 9.2 million acres of state trust land. So, you know, 17% of the land here is private. I think the state trust is the future corridor of growth, and a lot of these decisions will hopefully benefit the trust going forward in terms of the research that comes out of the initiative.
Mark, what about the skeptic who may say this has been a community that has relied so much on real estate and helping people make money off real estate? How do you, I think that's part of a challenge there too, to make people realize that even as you're talking about different stakeholders, the goal isn't to emphasize one over the other. It is to form some kind of, I'm going to say compact, but that's not the proper word in this case. How do you make that balance work when there are people who are thinking, I'm not sure I buy into this concept quite yet?
Yeah, Listen, we're a growth community, right? And because we have a vast amount of open land, it's easy to think that we have an unrestricted growth opportunity, and we don't. And we have regulation. I mean, real estate is the most regulated industry in the country, period. And that regulation comes from various levels of government. It is how you understand and manage through those various regulatory processes that allows you to optimize value, okay? If you just scream and yell and jump up and down because you're mad about it, it doesn't always get you a good result. And there's a number of things that are coming that we can either see as detrimental, or we can better understand them, work with the various stakeholders, and come up with a proactive approach. And I think that's kind of what Vanessa was talking about. And Vanessa, we can maybe make this case in point with the Endangered Species Act, which, you know, is this obscure thing to most people. We hear about it in terms of the endangered, you know, gray wolf and reintroducing it and things of that nature. We've not been as impacted in metropolitan Phoenix by endangered species. And we're talking about plant and animals, not just animals here. But that regulation is going to begin having significant impacts because there's a number of species that are being contemplated that will have impact on us. So this is an opportunity through this initiative to understand what those impacts will be, to work with the various stakeholders to see what their spatial impacts will be, what the economic trade-offs will be, so that we can begin to form an approach.
That's exactly right. And Maricopa County is the prime area to start looking at these type of solutions. we can learn from what was done elsewhere and what possibly could have been done better, what was done right, and implement some of those solutions in the growth corridor of the Phoenix metropolitan area. There are some proposed listings in the next few years that could have a significant impact on the home building industry and many other types of growth areas in our community that, if not done correctly, could lead to, you know, enormous offsets and impacts to our ability to continue growing as a community and growing responsibly.
Well, I think the growing responsibly is interesting, Mark. Follow up on that. But yeah. I'm also curious about the whole, this idea of where we, if we don't have something like this or something like this doesn't work, where does that leave this place in a quarter of a century?
Yeah, well, listen, the reason that these regulations exist isn't what we're trying to debate here, right? They do. They've been tested. And now it's a matter of their application. And if you allow one mentality of application to be the dictatorial approach, meaning it's only an environmental issue, we're going to have a problem. It's not just an environmental issue. And if we said, the hell with it, let's get rid of them totally and do whatever we want, that's not going to be good for creating a sustainable community. Our objective is to look at these various trade-offs. And I think that's what Vanessa's really going to try and do with this initiative. It is a real estate development and community development problem. But it's not one that we've typically seen approached through other initiatives or other programs.
And I think the perspective is that this can be done in harmony. There are appropriate planning measures to account for habitat and for mitigation lands associated with, you know, washes and wetlands. Done the correct way can lead to, you know, development that can be cost effective and still, you know, result in the necessary benefit for the home builder and the development community.
Yeah, and I think if we're after a sustainable place, this becomes important because it's our environment from an economic development standpoint, which is a big driver. It's our weather. It's our open space. These things do need to be protected.
Mark Stapp is director of ASU's Master of Real Estate Development Program. Vanessa Hickman is Arizona's former state land commissioner. We've been talking about the new large landowner initiative, which Vanessa will be in charge of. Guys, thanks for coming in. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Most, if not all, U.S. presidents see their approval ratings rise significantly after they leave office. Arizona Theater Company is banking on high approval ratings for its new production, an original called Five Presidents. The play by Hollywood producer and writer Rick Cleveland takes place in a conference room in Yorba Linda, California, at the funeral of Richard Nixon in 1994. The five presidents who were alive at the time, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, are gathered together. The event actually happened, but we don't know what was actually said. That's where Rick Cleveland's play comes in. I spoke with Cleveland earlier. How much knowledge did you have of each of the presidents, how they may have talked to each other, and how much creative license did you take? How much did you want to take?
I did a fairly thorough amount of research on all of them individually and as much as I could research them collectively, because some of them have, you know, post-presidency have relationships like Ford and Carter. They were friends. They were lifelong friends. I mean, to the point where Ford's death, Carter delivered one of the eulogies. They had made that promise to each other that whoever went first, the other one would deliver their eulogy. So I did a ton of research. And I was especially sort of, I had like a whole list that became about 200 pages of quotes that each of these guys had made. And not that I used all of them in the play, but I was able to use quite a few of them in the play. And then, yeah, I remember reading an interview with David Mamet. He was talking about Jimmy Hoffa, about writing that movie Hoffa, and he said he had read a couple of books, and then he put the books down and decided he had to take enough license to be able to treat this real life person as a character, and that always stuck with me. And I think that's what I ultimately wound up having to do with all five of these guys.
And how much audience trust do you care about when it comes to that? In the sense that when people think about these world famous leaders, there are certain things they remember about each of them, and they're some caricature, but also some remembering this issue or how the person spoke. Did you think about that, or was that just a way to create writer's block? You can't worry about that at that point.
No, absolutely, I worried about that. And the thing, I happened to have met a couple of these guys and been sort of backstage with them, Clinton especially, and they don't talk in private the way they do in public. And so that's part of what inspired me to want to do this. This is a fly on the wall play. So you get to hear these guys talk in a way that is different from, any speech you saw them make or any press conference you saw them give. So I wanted to make this play feel very much like you're a fly on the wall. And when it's over, hopefully it's entertaining for the 90 minutes that you're sitting there, but also that it's entirely credible.
Rick, this, I guess, comes off a little bit what you said about Ford and Carter, and we've heard a lot in recent years about how Clinton is like another son to George H.W. Bush and a brother to George W. Bush. Did the concept of a president's club sort of play into what you wrote, this idea that only someone who's held that office can really understand it?
Absolutely. Mark Clements had commissioned the play about a year before the President's Club came out. And what I had the idea to write this play during the first season of West Wing because a Bob Woodward book came out called Shadow. And the cover of that book had the iconic photo of all five of these guys at Nixon's funeral. And it wasn't really about the day of the funeral, but it was about how, even though Nixon is dead, the shadow he casts, it's changed the presidency forever. And it's about those, how Ford experienced that change and how Carter experienced it and all the way up until Clinton,
So what do the presidents talk about at the funeral in your play?
Well, they talk about, who's doing the eulogies. They make small talk. They make a fair amount of small talk. And they also can't help but air some grievances that they might have with one another. Okay. At this point, Clinton has only been in office a year, and a year and 2 months, and H.W. Bush is still a little in shock that he's no longer the president.
What sort of tone were you going for?
I don't seem to be able to write anything that doesn't have a little humor in it, and it certainly... I don't know, it just didn't feel to me, the context of that day in history and the amount of time that those guys would spend together, like 90 minutes, any longer than that would probably be pushing it because, they let's face it, they don't go fishing together. I mean, certainly George and Bill are friends now and they do a lot of charity work, and Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter hung out personally, with their wives and stuff. But, there's only how much are these guys gonna tear into each other on a day like this? They're smart, they're slick, they're empathetic, they know why they're there. No one's gonna make a scene that's so large it's going to interrupt what's going to happen, when they leave the room, the delivery of the memorials and the eulogies for Richard Nixon.
Whether it's West Wing or House of Cards or my buddy Bill that you worked on, I guess your made-up relationship with Bill Clinton, and also...
Well, it's as much fact as fiction in that piece.
Okay.
It's sort of a blend, a Mark Twain-like blend, I think.
Okay. But, and then with five presidents as well, there's a lot of stuff related to people in higher office, politics and politicians. There are a lot of people in the country who say they're really tired of politics and politicians and don't like them. And how difficult or how challenging is it to bring your love and interest and passion for that to an audience that may say, that's interesting, but boy, I really don't like those guys?
We've had over 20 performances in Tucson, and every single one of them has been met at the end with a rowdy standing ovation. And at first, I've seen it four or five times, but I read the reports from the stage manager. There has not been a performance that didn't have a standing ovation. Now, I could say, I must have written a really brilliant play, but that's not it. The performers are doing an amazing job, I think, portraying the men that they're portraying. That's a part of it, absolutely. But I think more than anything, sort of studying it, my belief is that the people in the audience are applauding the president that they've just spent time with on stage. Not the actors, but the presidents that the actors play. It's a very strange thing, but I think what happens in the play, I think people go into a play, they know it's about presidents, they're expecting that that the Republicans are going to beat up on the Democrats or vice versa, and the play is going to come down on one side or the other, that I'm going to give away my, political affiliation. But that I was determined not to do that, and I felt that that was also germane to their relationship, that it doesn't come up. You know, it may come up in little, tiny, funny, lines every now and then about Democrats versus Republicans. But there's no animosity the way there is today.
Rick, where did your passion for politics and people who hold higher office come from?
I don't really even remember this, but when I was about probably 7 or 8 years old, my mom said I was the only kid in the neighborhood who stayed indoors to watch the Watergate hearings. And I just only remember a little bit of that. I wrote a letter to Sam Ervin, the chairman of the Watergate Committee, and I actually got a letter back from him. That was my first fan letter. I really have an obsession with especially the office of the president. I sort of think that if you want the job, you should automatically not be allowed to have the job. I just really think that it's the worst job in the world, and I don't trust anybody that wants it.
Rick Cleveland, the writer of Five Presidents, which got its world premiere in Arizona. It'll open in previews in Phoenix tomorrow night at the Herberger Theater Center as an Arizona Theater Company production. Cleveland has also written for The West Wing and House of Cards. And still to come on Here and Now, we'll in spirit at least visit Antarctica with a couple of National Geographic explorers. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
Thanks for joining us this morning on 91.5. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. Well, Valley forecast calling for mostly sunny skies today, a high of 78 degrees, and then look for more sunshine tomorrow and through the weekend with a high of 81 tomorrow, 82 on Friday, and the low 80s for Saturday and Sunday. Stay with us at 12 for Here and Now from Boston. Today, Illinois' new governor has angered union leaders after going after state employees in a letter to the General Assembly. And NASA may be planning a mission to Jupiter's moon Europa. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Mostly sunny skies in Phoenix, and it's 65 degrees at 11:48.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Maybe last weekend you decided to hike Camelback Mountain, or you had some friends in for the Super Bowl and put your boots on for a challenging jaunt in the Superstitions. When the hike was over, you were a little tired but invigorated and got into a hot shower. National Geographic explorers Mike Lebecki and Corey Richards are polite guys, so they won't openly laugh at those of us who consider a hike in the valley to be challenging. Lebecki and Richards actually spent 10 days climbing to the summit of Bertha's Tower in Antarctica, and they're in studio with me to talk about that and their presentation tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Live speaker series. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.
I don't know which one to start with, Mike. Let me start with you on this. Antarctica, who thought that was a good idea?
Yeah, I love Antarctica. I mean, it really is sort of the most the most pristine continent on the planet. And it's an honor to actually go there and experience life in Antarctica. And, where we went to climb is possibly the most remote area you can climb on the planet. I mean, the nearest major city to where we're climbing is about 2,500 miles away. In today's day and age, we went to a place that rescue is impossible. And that's a big deal for today's day.
That seems incredibly daunting, Corey. So I have to ask, there's preparation, obviously, that goes involved, the practical stuff. But from a mental standpoint, I mean, with National Geographic, you've done a lot of things. You've been to a lot of interesting places. This sounds like beyond the mental scope of some of us to prepare ourselves for that.
Well, I think you just break it down into very, you know, natural, normal things that you do on a day-to-day basis, and you put yourself in a different environment, and everything's fine. You know, as a photographer and as a climber, it's always a challenge to kind of wrap your head around where you're going. And sometimes I think it's really, really important to do a lot of research. That helps your brain sort of start to grasp it. And sometimes I think it's best just to not do any research and just go and let yourself absorb it. And this was a little bit hard to wrap my head around, but not so much. I mean, it's, you know, it's a special place I always wanted to go to.
How about you guys as far as personalities? Are you similar?
I would say we're pretty different, though we have similar passions of climbing and being out in the wilderness and wanting to bring the stories home from these expeditions. But we're different people, but I think that we complement each other in the field because we are just ourselves. And it's interesting to be around people that are different from yourself. So, you know, on that note, it's really interesting because Corey and I just met on the way to Antarctica. So we met in Cape Town, South Africa before boarding the Russian flight, and we didn't know each other. And usually you go with friends, you go with friends, you go with friends. And we're going as complete strangers. Yet once we met, we had the same goal to go out there and climb and succeed and bring this story back for National Geographic. And so, you can hate each other, you can love each other out there. And we, fortunately, we fell in love. So,
Corey, is that true?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, I think
as a love affair continues.
We did total
Valentine's
field love
Day is like a week away, by the way.
Yeah, I know, right? It is. It was Brokeback Glacier. No, not quite. But it was a great great experience. And Mike and I, you know, we are very, very different people. We're incredibly. Mike's very earnest. He's very responsible. He's very pragmatic. He's very, you know, sort of dedicated. I'm just a little bit more, I'm the more crazy, aloof, kind of artistic one. But I think that works. There's a yin and yang effect. And certainly climbing takes creativity as well as pragmatism. And that's good.
So many of the missions involved with National Geographic have to do with helping an endangered species or finding out about something to let people know, like an important mission. Was there something deeper to this, or is this really a place that most people don't get to go, so we need to bring back the story?
There's something deeper to this in every way. And climbing, I talk about this at length. We, I think, as a human family are, increasingly sedentary, and we start to think of ourselves as apart from our natural world versus a part of. And climbing really makes you a part of it. And it puts that in pictures, and it puts it in words, and it puts it in video, and it makes people want to learn more about the planet. It inspires people to keep going, and that's how all of us got to where we are. Our ancestors were all explorers, and we need to remember that. We can't sit still. We have to keep discovering.
Mike, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, climbing and going on, being an explorer and a climber is somewhat a selfish pursuit, and it's been that way for a long time. But, if you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer, you immerse yourself into what you're passionate about, and you learn everything you can, and you become that person. One of the really, the second best part of being on one of these expeditions is being able to come home and share it. And, there's a huge value in that, to bringing these stories from, whether it's wilderness in your own backyard or in Antarctica halfway around the planet. You can inspire people to go out and get in nature. And that's what I'm hoping to do, is not only share these experiences that we're doing, that going to places no one will ever see, but just hoping to inspire people just to get outside and be in nature. That's really a big part of it for me, is in every way.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Mike Lebecki and Corey Richards, National Geographic Explorers. They hiked in Antarctica, and they'll talk about it tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series. How cold did it get, Corey?
I think in the tent at one point it was minus 31, but there was like 80-mile-an-hour winds outside. So when you throw in wind chill with that, you're looking at a very cold situation.
I mean, imagine living in temperatures colder than your freezer at home for 2 months. It gets a little interesting.
There were photos of you guys not wearing gloves. Mike, explain that.
Well, you have to be functional, and so you can't climb this rock with gloves on. Sometimes you can, but a lot of the times you got to take your gloves off, and you have to, get these little edges and put your fingers on them. But, some of the time it's not so cold, and so it gets up to 32, 33 degrees Fahrenheit where it's not so bad. But then when it gets into the negative temps, it really, you really have to put gloves on. So, but average temp, maybe zero in the single digits.
I want to make sure I get this term right. Katabatic winds, is that what those are? How would you describe those?
Well, katabatic winds are, you know, technically, they're winds that they're pressure systems that push winds down from the South Pole, from the high ice cap, down these sort of tunnel glacier areas. And we were in one of them. I'd been to Queen Maud Land twice before this and had a little bit of wind here and there. This was 80, 90% of the time, katabatic winds ferociously trying to destroy us. It was a real challenge.
Not to give anything away, because I think you guys are probably afraid of the air conditioning in our studios, but you're both wearing long sleeve shirts. Corey, you had a scarf on before. It's amazing to fathom that what you must have been going through in those sorts of temperatures.
Well, you know, it's funny. We are all so adaptable, and that's another thing that I like to talk about, is we all get very comfortable in our situation wherever we are, and it's important to understand that we are very, very, very dynamic animals, and we can adapt to almost any environment so long as we're prepared for it and we know about it. And you go down and people are like, you don't get cold? And you're like, no, of course I get cold. You just sort of get used to it. And your body gets used to it and you start functioning, you know, normally.
And, you know, you're really cold a lot down there. I mean, when you're in your sleeping bag, you're fine. But you're warm enough to function and not die when you're climbing. And so a lot of the times, you know, we'll show these images and stories. And it looks, you know, you can't really feel that. You know, you can see it in the videos. You can talk about the cold, but a lot of the times we're just surviving. We're just warm enough to function and climb until you get into your sleeping bag. And that, you know, that goes on to eating 5,000 calories a day just to keep the engine running and stay warm.
Well, so what's the greatest challenge of that particular climb?
Definitely was the climbing, for sure, but the cold. And not just the cold, but you add in the wind. For example, if you can't rappel, so if you can't get your equipment and use your equipment, your hands can freeze up. You can get hypothermic. You have to identify before you go into hypothermia, okay, it's getting too cold. We need to shut down and go back to our sleeping bags. And so being ready and the experience leading up to that is really what it took.
And though the two of you have been on amazing explorations before, was there anything about this particular one that changed you as people mentally or physically? You know, we all go through experiences that we will never forget and that impact our lives going forward. Was this that kind of trip for you, Corey?
You know, I think every single expedition, as cliche as it sounds, is one of those trips. But you can't go to these places and not be deeply impacted by them. You can't go and share these experiences with incredible friends and you know, partners and not be deeply impacted by that time spent together. That's an impossibility. We're too emotional as humans to not have these places impact us and make us care. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is all about.
Does that stay with you, though, once you get back to your normal life?
You know, not always. I mean, I think it's not kind of the near-death experience necessarily. And even near-death experiences, which I've had, don't always stay with you. You know, we get very wrapped up very quickly, and we start to sort of re-immerse ourselves in our own little narcissistic world. Mm. But that's, I think, why Mike and I do this and share this, is because it revives that experience.
I'd say, you know, we take these memories with us, of course, but I think what really happens is when you're out there, you grow deep roots of friendship and bonds and relationships that are going to last a lifetime. And you know, you can look back at the photos and the videos and the memories and this cold day or this beautiful moment on the summit. Yeah, you have these memories. They're great. But you're out there to be in the now and not thinking about other things. You're such in the hyper moment of now. And among that, when you are creating a friendship and bond like that with your partners, that starts those roots, and you're growing these trees of relationships that you have with them for forever. It's an incredible bond down there with your partners.
Corey, just a few seconds left, just to give people a really quick little dip in the water. What's your favorite photo people are going to see tonight?
It's Mike. It's a photo of Mike looking like he might not be enjoying something.
Is that the one where I'm naked on the summit?
Oh, yeah. No, that's definitely it. Yeah. No.
Corey Richards and Mike Lebecki, National Geographic Explorers. You can see them tonight at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series. Starts at 7:30. They will take you to Antarctica. Guys, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care.
And thanks very much for listening to Here and Now today. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. If you missed any of our segments or any of our past editions, go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org or download the KJZZ mobile app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day.
K- KJZZ is supported by Child's Play. The Boy Who Loved Monsters and the Girl Who Loved Peas is a play for families about imagination and fun. A friendly monster comes to life at Tempe Center for the Arts through March 8th. Child's Play, AZ.org.